Okay, good morning. This is Bio 231, and it is September 14th, 2 days away from a disaster drill. I don't know if you guys should know that or not, but anyway, there's a disaster drill on Wednesday. I don't think it's going to affect us, but if you have classes sometime on Wednesday, you might have to go along with the disaster drill. We had a test last time, and they're graded. Got the grades up on Blackboard over the weekend, so hopefully you could all check that out. But I recommend that everybody come by and take a look at their tests and see what they got wrong and what they got right, and check the answer key. Make sure you fill the answer key out correctly. There's a lot of ways that you could mess up, especially on the first test, because you don't know how an instructor writes a test. So come on by and check your answers out, and so next time you'll even do better. I think the grades were pretty good. You know, it all depends on what grade you got. Some students didn't do so well, and I'd like to see you improve quite a bit. So anyway, please come by during my office hours, and here you see my office hours in the syllabus. Always just check the syllabus for my office hours, okay? All right. So last time we did get into the axial skeleton. But I tell you what, any questions regarding the test or anything like that? Or if you're welcome to come by. I got a couple emails from students. I gave a lot of tests last week. I don't know what classes these emails were in, but I had students asking me if they could come by and take a look at the test. And, you know, you don't have to ask an instructor if you can come by and talk to them, right? Just they're supposed to be in their offices during office hours, so please, just come by. You don't need a special invitation, right, to do that. So please come by anytime for any reason. All right, so axial skeleton. Let's see. So we talked about some landmarks on bones. All right, vertebral column. So lab is very instrumental into knowing all of these kinds of things. All right, so let's start off with this slide right here. You should have a basic understanding of what bones belong to the axial skeletons and which one belong to the other skeleton. What's your other skeleton? Appendicular, that make your appendages, your upper appendage and lower appendage. All right, so the bones of the axial skeleton are found where? In the head, and the neck, and the thoracic cage, right? And that also means, what, the vertebral column. So head, vertebral column, rib cage. Maybe that's a good way of saying it. All right. And then everything else belongs to the appendicular skeleton, including some girdles, which we're going to talk about. Maybe we can get into that today. Girdles, what does it mean to girdle something? To surround. Right, to surround a structure is to girdle it. And there are some bones that kind of surround your upper thoracic cage. Those bones help attach your upper appendages to your axial skeleton. We call that the pectoral girdle. There's some bones that surround the axial skeleton that attach your lower appendage to your axial skeleton. That's what we call the pelvic girdle. Right, but still, those bones belong to the axial skeleton. Here we can see bones of the pelvic girdle and bones of the pectoral girdle right here. All right, so furthermore, we were looking at skull bones last time. I think this is a nice exam figure right here. All right, and if we're going to classify bones of the skull into two main categories, how would we like to do that? What's a really easy way to categorize bones of the skull? Two easy ways. Bones that make up something versus bones that make up something else. Okay, there's some that are facial bones, right, that are used for breathing, for communication, eating, things like that. And then there are bones that make up the cranium. What does the cranium do for us? It holds and protects the brain, right? So you should have in the back of your mind what bones belong to the cranium and which ones are facial bones. The other interesting thing about the skull is that there's only one bone that moves. What's the only bone that moves? Of all the bones that you've learned so far, there's only one that moves. And that is the mandible. That's right. And there's a pretty complicated joint. What do we call the joint that the mandible participates in? Okay, so be familiar with the mandible and this articulation right here. All right, what other bone is this? This is the temporal bone, and here's the mandible. So this joint is called the temporomandibular joint. Kind of wordy, so usually we just say what? TMJ. That's a TMJ. And that's kind of a complicated joint, all right, because not only does the mandible depress and elevate, all right, but it can protract, and it can also, what's that called? What's that motion called? Retract. It can protract and retract, all right, but it can also move laterally. It can perform a grinding motion. So it's a pretty complicated joint, and there's something like a knee meniscus in here. It's called an articular capsule, and a lot of people have problems with the temporomandibular joint as a result of that, because it's got so many ranges of motion. Now, who would you want to go see? What kind of physician would you want to see if you have a problem with your TMJ? Probably a dentist, right? Because they're most familiar with that particular joint. All right, so you got to be familiar with all of these different bones of the skull, and also what they look like when it's disarticulated. All right, so we have a number of disarticulated bones of the skull. All right, like this one right here, you should recognize that as the temporal bone plus all the little pieces of it, like the squamous region, the zygomatic process. Now, why do they call this the zygomatic process? Because it's articulating what? With what bone? The zygomatic bone, right? So it's a zygomatic process of the temporal bone. All right, that you should recognize as the sphenoid. Okay, my favorite bone, ethmoid. What's one function of the ethmoid bone? What's a good function to remember? Oh, yeah, it helps make up the nasal cavity, so it air conditions the air before it enters our lungs. So if the air is very dry, it humidifies it. If the air is really hot, it could cool it down to body temperature. If the air is cold, it can warm the air temperature up so the lungs don't freeze. Okay, a number of different functions. Plus, it has nasal sinuses, so it helps fight infection. It has lymphatic tissue. It has a crista galli, which is a shark's fin that's sticking up into the cranial cavity that holds onto the membrane system that holds the brain. And so the crista galli keeps your brain from sloshing around inside your cranium. That's really good. And in the cribriform plate, we have all these olfactory foramina so that olfactory nerves can go down into the nasal cavity so that you can perceive odors, so you have the sense of smell. So the ethmoid bone is really important. Mandible, okay, what kind of bone is a mandible? Is it a cranial bone or a facial bone? Facial bone. That has nothing to do with the brain. Okay, maxilla, cranial bone or facial bone? It's a facial bone as well. Okay. All right, so make sure you can pick out all of these different bones of the skull. And please don't forget that some of these bones have big cavities inside. And these are what we call the paranasal sinuses. There are four paranasal sinuses. They're filled with lymphatic tissue, so it helps fight infection from pathogens that we're breathing into our bodies all the time. So the four bones that have paranasal sinuses are the maxillary bone, the ethmoid, the sphenoid, and the frontal bone. And these sinuses, paranasal sinuses, are just named after the bones where they're found. Okay. All right, so the spinal column, or vertebral column, is made up of vertebrae. And here we see all the vertebrae. All right, so I think this is new material for us. All right, here are the vertebrae. And notice that there are a number of different sections. All right, the most superior set we call cervical vertebrae. They make up the neck. All right, the next division, right, helps make up the rib cage. So we call these the thoracic vertebrae. And notice as the vertebrae, as we move down the vertebral column from superior to inferior, what's the general, how does the general shape of these vertebrae change if we were just to casually look at this vertebral column right here? They get bigger. They get larger and larger and larger. And of course, that's necessary because the vertebrae that are most inferior have to support more and more weight, right, compared to the more superior vertebrae. Hardly have to support any weight whatsoever. And of course, when you stress a bone, when you put weight on a bone, what happens to it? It gets bigger and stronger naturally all by itself, right? Okay, so did I talk about osteoporosis in here? You don't think so? Do you think I did or not? No? Okay. Well, you know, there's a swine flu virus going around, and there's a lot of concern because a lot of people think that a lot of us might come down with it. And, you know, we have to be concerned. But, for instance, if there is a flu, there's a really nasty cold that was going around this summer, too. Now, does everybody come down with the flu or this cold that was going around this summer? No. Okay? And why is it that we all don't come down with the same illness? Why is that? Why do you think that is? I don't know. Take a look around the room once. What do you see? Do you see yourself anywhere in the room? No, we're all different, right? We're all a lot different. We're very similar in most of the ways, but we are all different. This is a diverse population, right? So it's very rare to have a disease process that will affect everybody in a diverse population. And indeed, that's the beauty of having a diverse population, okay? But osteoporosis is kind of a strange disease process because it's something that will affect all of us if we're lucky enough to live long enough. All right, so that's why I think it's an interesting disease process. And what happens is that bones, as we get older, demineralize and they get weaker. They can't withstand compression. And they then are prone to fracture and compression fractures. And that particularly happens with women because they generally have less bone to give away as they get older compared to males. Males typically have bigger, stronger bones, so when they lose a little bit, it doesn't affect them very much. Nonetheless, they still lose bone as they get older. So that's kind of interesting. Now, how can you protect yourself from osteoporosis? And this is the reason why people hate taking classes, is why? Calcium, that means diet. Take calcium in your diet. And exercise. That's right. So diet and exercise protects you from osteoporosis. Osteoarthritis is a different kind of process than osteoporosis. Osteoarthritis is when the cartilage around the joints, within the joints, actually degenerate. Okay, and that could be due to repetitive use, or that happens to when you traumatize a joint, and it just happens sometimes to people as they get older. But there are different kinds of arthritis too. Okay, but that usually has a little bit later onset in life, osteoarthritis, and it's kind of a natural process. And again, to protect yourself from osteoarthritis, guess what's a good thing? The proper kind of exercise and the proper kind of diet as well. So again, diet and exercise. Because let's go back to osteoporosis. When you stress a bone, how does it respond? It gets bigger and stronger. So you actually deposit calcium in that bone when you exercise. All right, and this is especially true for females premenopausally, to make sure that you have proper calcium in your diet, proper vitamin D so that you can absorb that calcium, and exercise so that it's what? Deposited in your bones. And when we finish this anatomy class and you take a physiology class, you'll probably learn that calcium is needed in your body for a whole range of purposes. And probably the last one of importance is to have the proper level of calcium in your bones. It's probably the last place where you would choose to put it if you needed to get some in a hurry. All right, so that's pretty interesting to just be aware of that. All right, so these lumbar vertebrae, okay, are prone to osteoporosis because what are they designed to do? Hold a lot of body weight. All right, so they can compress with osteoporosis. All right, so the superior vertebrae right here we call cervical vertebrae, and there's seven of them. All right, the thoracic region has how many? There are 12 of them. All right, and we usually don't name vertebrae. We don't give them a name, for instance, like John or Jill or whatever. We just give them a number, and then also we designate the division that they're in. So the first thoracic vertebrae we say is T1, thoracic 1. And we usually don't waste time saying thoracic, and that goes down to number 12. And the number of thoracic vertebrae that somebody has got to be exactly equal to the number of pairs of ribs that they have. It's got to be exactly the same. And there might be somebody in here that only has 11 pairs of ribs instead of the usual 12. That's not that big a deal. If we were to image everybody in here, we might find somebody, maybe even a couple people. And that's just what we call anatomic variation. It's just a natural variation. It's not pathologic at all. So if you have 11 pairs of ribs, guess how many thoracic vertebrae you have? You would have 11. By definition, all right, the number of pairs of ribs you have has to match exactly the number of thoracic vertebrae you have. You can't have more or less. Okay. All right, and then the lumbar division here, are there any ribs attached to the lumbar division? Absolutely not. Never. That never happens. Okay, there are 5 lumbar vertebrae. So how are you going to remember that there are 7 cervical, 12 thoracic on average, okay, or just that's the normal number, and 5 lumbar? How are you going to remember that? Unless you're really good at memorizing. A lot of people are pretty good, I got a feeling, in here. But I always like to have a little bit of a trick, right? In case I have to give a lecture in 20 years and I haven't really revisited a topic, right? I can rely on a trick to bring some recall back. Okay, well, think of meal times. Like, when would you have breakfast, maybe? Okay, 7 a.m., and when would you have lunch? At noon, okay, or 12, and then supper typically is at 5. All right, so think of 7, 12, and 5, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and that might help you remember the number of vertebrae in these different divisions. Okay. The sacrum right here, that's part of the vertebral column, but you notice that these are quite a bit different because all of these vertebrae are fused together. And there are usually 5 of them. This region is even a little bit more variable, say, than the thoracic region. Okay, so there can be a variable number, but 5 is really good. And then the very inferior part right here, the coccygeal vertebrae, or sometimes we just call it the coccyx, these are all fused together as well. And this is a highly variable region, anywhere from 5 to 3 vertebrae fuse in this region. Not clinically too important, but of course if you fracture this joint right here, that's very painful. But typically, that's not of any kind of clinical significance. As opposed to pathology, but at the more superior regions of the vertebral column. Right, that's very significant kind of pathology then. That might produce motor deficits or sensory deficits, or even paralysis if it becomes damaged. Okay, so if we look at the vertebral column with a lateral view, we notice that it's not straight. It has curvatures associated with it, right? And these are good things because we have some anterior curvatures, for instance, in the cervical region, and in the lumbar region right here, we have some posterior curvatures in the thoracic region, and the sacral region right here, these posterior curvatures are making room for something. Okay? Yeah, and the thoracic right here is making room for the lungs that need to inflate and the heart, pretty important organs. So these posterior curvatures allow for these organs to exist in these, in this thoracic cavity. And the sacral curvature right here just allows for pelvic organs, gives room for the pelvic organs, like uterus, okay, urinary bladder, large intestine, things like that. But if your vertebral column was all posterior, guess how we would have to walk around? We'd have to be leaning way forward, right, if all of our organs were, okay, way posterior on our body. We'd have to move our center of balance way over, so the spine has some other curvatures as well. Right, like the cervical curvature recenters your body mass more over the center of your pelvis so that you have better balance. Then the same thing for the lumbar curvature as well. It helps just reposition weight so that it's easier to maintain balance. So that's the reasons for those particular curvatures. Okay. Notice a couple other things on this diagram right here. In between the vertebrae, there is some cartilage, fibrocartilage, that's what we call an intervertebral disc, and that again helps cushion trauma from being transmitted from one vertebral body to the next. Right, the very center is the nucleus pulposus, that's not very strong, but there is an outer ring of fibrocartilage, and that's what we call the annulus fibrosus. That's the tough one. And if the tough annulus fibrosus is herniated, this material, this gel-like material from the pulposus can squish out, and it might even squish out into this hole that we see between vertebrae. What do we call a hole in a bone? That's a foramen. And this particular foramen right here is called the intervertebral foramen because it's in between vertebrae, and this is how nerves enter or leave the spinal cord. And if they get compressed, and then that nerve loses function, or that function is disturbed, and that can produce paralysis, or can produce inappropriate sensation, or painful sensation as well, okay, when a disc is herniated. All right, but basically what I wanted to tell you about was this intervertebral foramen. Okay. So what you should be familiar with is just the general structure of any kind of vertebrae. And you're going to do a really good job of this in lab, I'm sure. But from memory, I know I have all my lab students draw this diagram out just from memory. Oh, I like that. It just zoomed in a little bit. All right, so you should probably do that no matter whose lab you're in. So this right here is the center of mass of a vertebrae, and we call that the body or the centrum. The other thing maybe you should know is what kind of bone is a vertebrae? Is it a long bone? Is it a sesamoid bone? As a matter of fact, you're right. It's an irregular bone. So that's probably something you should know. Okay. Know different kinds of bones and how they're classified. All right, here is a hole. And this hole is for the spinal cord. And that's called the vertebral foramen. So is it obvious what the difference between the intervertebral foramen is compared to the vertebral foramen? Don't get mixed up on those, right? All right, then we have a couple bony plates that come off the body. These are what we call the pedicles. Here's a pedicle, here's a pedicle. And then there's another bony plate that we call lamina. Right, so there are two pedicles, two lamina, and these form an arch coming off the vertebral body, and that completes the bony armor that protects the spinal cord. Right, so that's very important. All right, but in order to stabilize the vertebral column, what do you need? I passed over some ligaments and things like that, but mostly the vertebral column is stabilized, and it's protected by strong muscles of the back. All right, so what do muscles need to attach to a bone? It needs a process of some kind, right? So that's going to be a landmark on a bone. And so this right here is a process. This is what we call a transverse process. Guess what the function of this transverse process is? Anytime you hear that word process, you should think of a function, and the function is, even without thinking, you should say muscle attachment. Okay, just automatically say muscle attachment. Same thing for this transverse process over here. Straight posterior, we have a spinous process. Guess what the function of this spinous process is? Oh, you guys, are you sleeping or what? Anytime I say process, what should you say for the function? Just say muscle attachment, right? And then later on, we'll learn some names of muscles that work in this region right here. So there are lots of muscles all over the place. All right, stabilizing these vertebrae. Okay, so that's what you should be able to draw from memory. The body, the pedicle, the lamina, transverse process, spinous process. The other thing that you notice on this particular slide, I think this is an exam figure, we see some facets. We see some depressions right here. And there is articular cartilage in these areas. So these things right here are important because they form joints. All right, so we notice that there was a joint between the vertebral bodies protected by the intervertebral discs, but vertebrae also articulate via these facets right here. This is a superior articulating process, all right, so it's a bump with a facet right here. This is going to articulate with the vertebrae above it. And then down underneath, there's going to be an inferior articulating process and facet as well. So in lab, make sure you can pick one of these things up, turn it around. And how can you prove to yourself that this is an articulating facet and not just a rough process for muscle attachment? How could you prove that to yourself? You could palpate it with your fingertips, right? You could use all those little Merkel's discs and just see how smooth, right, these different facets are right here. Now, the other thing that I notice on this vertebrae, I see another articulating facet here and here, and these we would find on a thoracic vertebrae because this is where a rib is going to attach. The head of a rib will attach on the body of a vertebrae, and then the tubercle of a rib is going to attach to the transverse process. So a rib is going to come off kind of in this fashion, like this, and then course and bend and course anteriorly around. So a rib is attached at two locations on a vertebrae and not just one. Okay. All right, so I said that most vertebrae don't have a name. They just are given a designation and a number, like T1, T2, right? L1 through L, what? When do you have dinner? 5, L5, right? Okay, except for the first two vertebrae. They're very special. And so we actually give them names. C1, all right, is the first cervical. And C1 kind of looks strange because it doesn't have a vertebral body. Now, where do you find the body of a vertebrae at? Is it posterior or anterior? It's going to be the anterior part of that vertebrae because on the posterior side, what do you got? You can feel them all. All those spinous processes sticking out in your back, right? So the body is anterior. Notice that C1 is missing the vertebral body. It actually has gone someplace. We're going to see where it has gone in just a second. All right, so this typically is easy to see as C1 because it's missing the vertebral body, and it's named after the mythological figure, probably is even considered a god, that's holding up the world. What's the name of that mythological figure holding up the world? That is Atlas, because C1 is holding your head up. And for you, what's that? That's your world, basically, right? You wouldn't want to go anywhere without your head. Okay. All right, so the joint between C1 and the bone of the skull, that's actually the cranial bone. Does anybody know what bone that is? That's right above the vertebral column. That is the occipital bone in the back, right? The occipital bone in the back. All right, so the kind of motion that's allowed between C1, or atlas, and the occipital bone is just a simple yes motion. You can only rock your head back and forth like this. All right, but you do know that you can rotate your head. All right, you can rotate your cervical spine like this. But that kind of motion, which is what if rocking anterior and posterior is the yes motion, what is the rotation motion? Are we going to call that? That's like your least favorite answer, right? That's no. Okay. All right, so the no motion cannot take place between C1 and the occipital bone. And if it does, right, that's a very inappropriate motion, something's going to break. All right, and you should be really concerned about that because where's one of the last places you want to have a fracture in your body? Your vertebral column, right? Okay. So any kind of head trauma is very dangerous to the cervical spine because the joint between C1 and the occipital bone can only rock back and forth. And you can see that C1 is pretty, it's not a massively strong looking bone, and it can fracture relatively easily. Fortunately, when it fractures, it can fracture in kind of a stable configuration. You can live very nicely as long as you're transported to the hospital properly, right? And the spinal cord won't be injured, and then you just have to wear a halo for 6 weeks or something that will just immobilize your neck, and you'll kind of be fine after that. All right. So here's a transverse process, and here's a transverse process, and I want to say, look at these holes right here. We didn't see those on the previous slide. Those are what we call transverse foramina, and this is a characteristic of all cervical vertebrae. No other vertebrae have these except for the cervical region, so that's a nice, what we say, distinguishing feature of the cervical vertebrae. All right, so let's find out what happened to the vertebral body of C1. Well, and this is just a little bit different view, inferior view. Here is C2, and this is where the body of C1 ended up. It is fused to the body of C2, and we call that the dens, or we might give it another name. We call that the odontoid process. Okay, and C2 has got a name because it allows for rotation. Right, this dens right here almost acts like an axle that C1 can rotate around, and so we call C2 the axis for right lateral rotation, left lateral rotation. So that's what is allowed between C1 and C2, is a rotation, which is what kind of motion again? What do we call that?
No.
That's the no motion. Okay. But if because of some kind of trauma, right, if the joint between C1 and C2 goes through a yes kind of motion, guess what happens? It's inappropriate for that joint. This dens has a tendency to fracture off, and guess where it goes? Really unfortunate. It usually goes straight posterior into the spinal cord, and that's immediately fatal when that happens. Okay? So make sure you know the two different kinds of motions between occipital bone and C1, and the motion between C1 and C2 are radically different. And, of course, it has, what, immense clinical applications, right? Whether you're going to live and be fine or what? Die immediately, right? So there's a huge difference just because of the structure of these vertebrae. All right, so here we know this is C2. We can see for sure because it's the dens, but it's also, where does it belong? In what part of the vertebral column? It's in the cervical region. And what do all cervical vertebrae have? What should they have? Transverse foramina. And do you see it on C2? On this picture right here. Yeah, absolutely, right? So that's a nice dead giveaway that it's a cervical vertebrae. Another feature of cervical vertebrae, all right, is that the spinous process here usually doesn't come off just as a single process, but we see that it is bifurcated, meaning that there are two points on it. So we say that it is a bifid spinous process, and that's a characteristic of all cervical vertebrae. You won't find that on thoracic or lumbar vertebrae. Okay, so here you can see a nice illustration that shows how C1 and C2 come together, right, to form that joint that allows for rotation, because this transverse ligament on C1 holds the odontoid process in the correct position. And notice all of these spinous processes are what? Bifid. They have a bifid nature to them. Okay, thoracic vertebrae. The spinous process is angled inferiorly. It's not bifurcated at all, and it's very long. And there are also facets for articulation with what other bones in your body, if it's a thoracic vertebrae? Yeah, ribs, because ribs, by definition, have to articulate with a thoracic vertebrae. So I see one here on the transverse process. And then lumbar vertebrae, much different. The body is massive. It's huge. The spinous process is not angulated inferiorly. It's actually kind of sticking straight posterior, and it's square. Okay, so it looks quite a bit different. Okay, the sacrum, 5 fused vertebrae. And instead of having intervertebral foramina, it either has the anterior sacral foramina for nerves entering or leaving the spinal cord, or on the posterior side, these are the exact same holes, but they're named differently depending on what aspect you're looking at, because different nerves will leave the posterior route versus the anterior route, so we have to, even though it's the same hole, we have to talk about it differently. This bony plate right here is the ala, and you're going to find a ridge right here that we call the sacral promontory, and the vertebral foramen of all these vertebrae have fused, right? So now we see that it is really a canal. So here is the sacral canal that nerves go through, and this opening down over here on the posterior end we call the sacral hiatus. So a hiatus, right, that could be another hole in some kind of anatomical structure. All right, so that's it for the sacrum. Okay. The thoracic cage is made up of, posteriorly, the vertebrae. What vertebrae are these right here? These have to be thoracic vertebrae. Anteriorly, it is the breastbone, which we call the sternum. Okay, and the sternum has got a couple parts to it. The most superior part is the manubrium. This middle part is the body, and then this most inferior part is the xiphoid process, right, which in us probably is an isossified piece of cartilage, so it's no longer cartilage. These bones fuse together. It's not important that they move. Okay, the xiphoid process is just weakly attached to the body, and that could be important clinically, for instance, when somebody's heart stops or they stop breathing. Right, there are techniques that people learn to actually help somebody when they're unconscious because their heart isn't beating or they're not breathing. We can actually breathe for them. We can actually help their heartbeat by doing chest compressions. Right, so what's that called? That's called CPR, right? And you can save somebody's life because when somebody's heart stops, how long do they have before they're brain dead? If somebody can't start their heart up, and none of us can really start somebody's heart up in here because we don't have the equipment to do that, all right? But so when is somebody gonna die when their heart stops beating? After 3 minutes. That's right. So not a very long period of time, right? So CPR really can save a lot of lives. That extends that period of time for, you know, I don't know, could be hours even. So if you know CPR. Oh, there's probably a defibrillator someplace. It's called an AED, Automatic Electronic Defibrillator. I don't know where it's at. It might be in the student center, and I'm not sure there is one. But what's really fortunate is that I know where there's one about a block away, and that is, I know that doesn't sound like a big deal. It is, right, because if you're unconscious, you can't run over and get it, but there are trained people that know how to use it, and they practice their whole life how to get someplace really fast. What place am I talking about? The fire station, right, just across from the baseball field. So if we don't have one on campus, right, the fire station has one, or they have trained EMTs over there, and they can get you going again really quick, right, and they can probably be here in a couple minutes. But let's not test them, okay? All right, so this xiphoid process is important because if you're doing chest compressions on somebody, it can fracture. And that fracture, that bone is very sharp, and when you're doing chest compressions, it can migrate around. And where can it go? Well, it can move into the liver, right, and lacerate the liver. So now you really haven't helped somebody, right, because now they have a massive hemorrhage, plus their heart isn't breathing, plus they're not breathing. Or it can even move into the pericardium, right, and cut the pericardium and lacerate the heart as well. So when somebody's doing chest compressions, that's a nice landmark that you feel for, and then you move where? Above it, yeah, to press on the what? The body of the sternum, right, to do chest compressions. All right, so some other things you got to know. This forms a little angle, the manubrial body joint right here. That's what we call the sternal angle. The jugular notch is this dimple in the superior part of the manubrium. And even the clavicular notch is right here. All right, you should know. All right. So we have 12 thoracic vertebrae. How many ribs do we got to have? We've got to have 12. All right, they're broken down into two main regions. The superior 7 we see attached directly to the sternum, either the manubrium or the body. And this is just what we call a costal cartilage. The superior 7 do, so these are what we call true ribs. All right, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. This one attaches to rib number 7. Rib number 8 has a costal cartilage, but it doesn't go directly to the sternum. Where does it go? It goes to the cartilage of number 7 right here, right? So all of the ribs below number 7 we call false ribs for that reason. And furthermore, the most inferior 2 ribs don't have any cartilage on them whatsoever, so those are false ribs for sure, but they're also called floating ribs because they have no cartilage whatsoever. All right, so that's what you should know about the thoracic cage. All right, let me go to my notes and see if I need to fill anything in. Oh, you know what? I think we're doing pretty good with axial skeleton. All right. So in lab, you got to know probably some more pieces of these things. Make sure you know the different divisions, right? Cervical, thoracic, lumbar, how many are in each. And in lab, you're going to have to be able to identify a vertebrae as belonging to one division or another. And is that hard to do? It's not hard to do. You can do it from across the room as long as you know what to look for, right? So make sure you pay attention to your lab instructor when you cover that material. As a matter of fact, I should probably have one in my pocket, but I don't, to show you. I can quiz you all right now. All right, so any questions with axial skeleton? Nope. Okay. Okay. So maybe I'm going to close some of these things down so I'm not so confused. Okay. And I guess I'm confused already. I want to keep that open. All right, so let's move on to the next chapter, which is appendicular skeleton, number 8. Okay, so I'm going to use the slides, a lot of these slides right here. All right, so actually we probably could have looked at the first slide from the previous chapter because it broke down the bones into axial and appendicular skeleton. All right, so it's not just bones of your arms and legs, but it's also the girdles. All right, so the first girdle we're going to talk about is the pectoral girdle. And there are two bones that make up the pectoral girdle. And remember, girdle means to surround. So there's going to be a bone that's anterior. There's going to be a bone that's posterior. The anterior bone is the clavicle right here. The posterior bone is the scapula. All right, so this is what attaches your arm to your axial skeleton. And as a matter of fact, there's only one joint that holds your whole arm to your axial skeleton. And this is it right here, the manubrioclavicular joint. That's the only joint that is holding your whole arm to your body. All right, so you might wonder, well, how is it stabilized? Well, it's stabilized because of all of the muscles, right, that attach to bones of the axial skeleton and the humerus or the scapula. Right, so muscles are really responsible for stabilizing joints. Okay, only in a few circumstances does the shape of a joint really perform a major stabilizing function. All right, so you got to know the bones of the pectoral girdle are the anterior is the clavicle and posterior is the scapula. All right, notice that the clavicle, you've really got to pay attention to this in lab. Okay, there's a nice curvature associated with it because the clavicle is tightly wedged in between the manubrium and this part of the scapula, which we call the acromion process. So maybe if you go back and look at your regional terms for test number 1, which you might have thought was pretty boring to memorize all those different parts of your body, but now you're going to use these to name processes and important other parts of your body. So go back and look at those regional terms one more time. All right, so the clavicle is wedged really tight right in here. So when your shoulder experiences some kind of trauma, right, especially lateral trauma that's going to compress the clavicle, it's got nowhere to go. So guess what happens? The clavicle fractures routinely as a result of that, okay, because it doesn't have any place to give or to move out of the way. And there's a huge blood vessel that travels from your heart that feeds blood to your entire arm, and that's called the, and this is why it's really important to know all your bones, it's named after the clavicle. It's called the subclavian artery, meaning what? Underneath the clavicle bone. It's a huge, huge artery. And when this clavicle, since it fractures all the time, you might think that it'd be really easy to damage that subclavian artery. And you could bleed to death if it gets lacerated. Fortunately, because of this curvature right here, what has evolved, because if it didn't break properly, that person or that animal eventually would die, actually die in a hurry. The fracture of a clavicle always proceeds where? Anteriorly. away from the subclavian vein. So that's an interesting feature of that curvature. All right. And so when somebody has a broken clavicle, you can't cast that region. So it's not uncommon after a fracture of the clavicle, what do you have? You've got a big bump sticking out from your shoulder right there. And it's rare that that is ever revised. Maybe if somebody's really concerned with cosmetics or something, they might get it shaved off, but it really has no clinical significance. Other than what? The way that it fractured did what? It saved your life, right? So it's actually kind of a nice trade-off, I think. Okay. All right, so you have a couple different ends. You have one under the clavicle that articulates with the manubrium. And if we were to look at it on end, it would be very circular. It would look like the opening of a clarinet or a trumpet or something. All right, it's very big. The acromial end is very flat. You can't really appreciate it from this diagram, so you got to get into lab and know. And for sure, you're going to have to know the manubrial end from the acromial end. So remember, the acromial end is more like a knife blade. It's flat. But the manubrial end is what? Is more trumpet-shaped or like a opening of a clarinet. It's much more massive. All right, and then there's this conoid tubercle on the clavicle that helps stabilize the shoulder joint. So there are ligaments and muscles that attach to this tubercle right here that help stabilize the shoulder joint. All right, so that's the first bone of the what? Of the pectoral girdle. Yeah, pectoral girdle. All right, the second bone is which one? The scapula. All right, scapula's got a lot of interesting pieces to it, and it might look confusing at first, but when you get into lab, pick up a bone, all right, and this is going to be really helpful for a lot of bones, put it where it belongs on your body, right? Make sure that the anterior is the anterior side, the right one is on the right side and not on the left side, it's not upside down. Model it on your body, and then it's going to make a whole lot more sense. As a matter of fact, it might make perfect sense really fast. All right, so here we see two aspects of the scapula, and this is in your back. This is the aspect that you're most familiar with right here. This is the posterior side of the scapula. So when you give somebody a back rub, or if you've ever had a back rub, this is the part that is massaged. Right? There are a couple depressions in the scapula. What do we call a depression in a bone? A fossa. Right? So this one right here is called the infraspinous fossa. What's the function of a fossa? It's for holding something. And in this particular one, it's holding a muscle. And guess what the name of the muscle is? Right? This is what the really cool thing about knowing your bones. Once you know bones, you know muscle anatomy, neuroanatomy. It is the infraspinatus muscle. Right? So now you're automatically learning muscle. So the infraspinatus is over here. Here's another fossa. This is the supraspinous fossa. And there's a big muscle in this one right here. Guess what the name of this muscle is? The supraspinatus, right? And in between, this is the spine of the scapula. It's a big, massive, bony ridge, okay, which you'll recognize very nicely. All right, now if we look at the posterior side, so let's flip over to here. Here is another depression, all right? But this is where? This is the anterior, so if you have to go all the way through your body to get to the anterior side of the scapula. All right, so you can't really reach this one. It's kind of hard to imagine because of that. But there's another muscle right here. Guess what the name of that muscle is? That is the subscapularis, because this is the subscapular fossa. So remember, supraspinatus or supraspinous fossa, infraspinous fossa, and subscapular fossa for holding muscles. And you see that we have the lateral border of the scapula, because where is that pointing? So when you model this bone in lab, how is that going to be pointing? Lateral angle is going to be pointing laterally, right? And how is that easy to tell that that's a lateral aspect? Because I tell you what, see this depression right here? This is a glenoid cavity. Right, and this forms an articulation with the humerus. And so where do you have your humerus? Is it medial or is it lateral? It's going to be lateral, right? So this has got to be the lateral border right here. Always look for this glenoid fossa. Sometimes it's called the glenoid cavity, fossa or cavity, either one, all right, which is going to be lateral. Something that looks like a bird's beak right here, that's the coracoid process. And the actual tip of your shoulder, which is coming off the scapular spine, that's the acromion process. All right, so those are all important things to know. What else do you have to know about? Well, here's the superior angle. Here's the inferior angle. All right, and this, if this is the lateral border, here is the medial border. So if you got to name these things in lab or in a test, get some sleep the night before, right, so you don't get it turned around in your mind. All right, it's easy to mix up. And then there's a little suprascapular notch right on the superior margin of the scapula. All right, so I think that pretty much goes over the scapula, which is, oh, here's another good picture, which is what? The second bone in the pectoral girdle. Here you can see the different cavities. Like this is the infraspinous fossa. What fossa is this right here? That's the supraspinous fossa, and then here is the subscapular fossa. Right, so sub means below. Right, now you might say, well, why is that below? Because this is on the superficial side of your body, and as you move from over here, you proceed more deeply, right? And then sooner or later, you're going to get into the thoracic cavity. So this actually is what? The subscapular fossa. This is the deep fossa of the scapula. And again, here's that coracoid process and acromion process, and here's a little bit of a glenoid cavity. All right, now let's see if I can, you know, I do want to say one other thing about that glenoid cavity. All right, it forms a special kind of joint that we call a ball and socket joint. So the head of the humerus, oops, which is this thing right here, this is the ball, it's going to articulate with a glenoid cavity. Now, does this glenoid cavity look really deep or does it look pretty shallow? I don't know how you can get an impression of this, all right, but does this look like a bowl you could put a lot of cereal in, or does it look more like a plate? It looks pretty flat, actually, okay? So that has some interesting features, right? And because the ball and socket joint, when the glenoid cavity of that ball and socket joint, because it's not very deep, it means that you have a lot of range of motion with the shoulder. You have a lot of dexterity. You can move your arms anterior and posterior, right? You can raise them above your head and below. You can put your hands behind your back. A large range of motion. But when you have a large range of motion, guess what? You have to give something away. And what is the thing that you're giving away with the shoulder joint because you have a large range of motion? Compared to another joint we're going to look at in just a little bit. Okay? It means that the shoulder is inherently not very stable. All right? So, and it's not very strong compared to another ball and socket joint that we're going to compare this with or contrast it with. All right? So, range of motion is gained at the expense of what? Stability and strength because of the shape of the shoulder joint, or we could call it the glenohumeral joint. Okay. All right, so let's move down into the upper appendage. And don't forget, what do you call that part of your body between your shoulder and your elbow? That is your, that's your arm, okay? And how many bones do you have in your arm? You got one, which is the humerus. All right, some people are smiling because it's strange. Maybe I didn't say it before. But what do you call that part of your body between your elbow and your wrist? Is that your arm? No, absolutely not. That's your forearm, right? So that's why I want to make sure you know where your arm is, okay, in anatomy class. Okay, so here is the head of the humerus. It's an articulating surface. So when you palpate it in lab, how should it feel? Which of those Merkel's discs tell you? It's smooth, right? Unless it's arthritic, then it's going to be rough and jagged. All right, and then there's a little bit of a narrowing before we get to this very rough bony prominence right here. And since this is a little narrowing, we have a tendency to call that the neck, right? There is the neck. And it's still a pretty massive bone right here, and it's rare that this area fractures. If there's going to be a fracture of the humerus, it usually occurs a little bit more distal in this part of the humerus right here. So this is what we call the surgical neck. It's just a narrowing of the humerus in a location where it has a tendency to fracture because it's not quite so massive. And in between the surgical neck and anatomic neck, we see a number of very rough bony prominences. These are tubercles, and a tubercle is a process. So what's the function of these tubercles right here? That's going to be for muscle attachment. So we're going to learn some muscles that attach right here. The greater tubercle is bigger than the lesser tubercle, and we see that there is a groove or a sulcus between the tubercles, and so we call that the intertubercular groove. And there's a very important muscle, namely the biceps. There's one part of the biceps that has a tendon that runs right through this groove and actually attaches to the scapula, which we're going to get to eventually. All right. Here's another bony process. This is the deltoid tuberosity. Guess what the name of the muscle is that attaches here? It's the deltoid muscle, right? Okay. Let's see, what else do you have to know about the humerus? This region down over here. All right, now this region you're going to have to pay attention to. It's a little bit more complicated. Whenever there's a smooth surface on a bone for articulation, sometimes we can call it a condyle. Right? It's going to be nice and smooth and covered with cartilage. Here are a couple other condyles on the distal humerus for attaching to bones of the forearm. And we see the lateral one is what we call the capitulum, and it looks kind of like a ball. It's very spherical. And then this other one is what we call the trochlea. Kind of looks like a bobbin that you would wind some thread up on. All right, so trochlea looks like the bobbin, and the capitulum kind of looks like a ball right here. And these are for articulating with bones of the forearm. All right, bones, you only have one in the arm, but you have two bones in the forearm. Okay, the lateral one, right, so how can you tell what's medial and lateral on the humerus? Well, the head of the humerus is going to be pointing which way? Laterally or medially? It's got to be medially to attach with the scapula, right? Okay, so this lateral articulating surface is going to articulate with a lateral bone in the forearm, and that is the radius. Okay. And when you flex your forearm, the part of the radius has to fit into the humerus, this little depression right here. And so we call that the radial fossa, because what fits into the radial fossa when you flex your forearm? It's going to be the lateral bone in the forearm. That's the radius. So that's the radial fossa. Okay, here's another depression right here. And this one accepts a big, massive process from the ulna. We could have called this the ulnar fossa, all right? But the part of the ulna that fits into this space right here is called the coronoid process, and so we call this the coronoid fossa in this distal part of the humerus. So this is a nice anterior view, and you might have to know what the posterior view of the humerus is, so let's turn it around. There's a big depression right here. When you extend your forearm, there is a big, even bigger process, bigger than the coronoid process. It's called the olecranon process of the ulna, and it has to fit into this depression. So we call this the olecranon fossa. So it's very easy to tell the difference between the posterior humerus and the anterior humerus over here. All right, so let's look at some bones of the forearm. Laterally, we've got the radius, and medially we have the ulna. They're connected with a ligament, which we call the interosseous membrane. It's not very strong. It just lightly stabilizes these two bones. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Where's that sign-in sheet at? I think I have it in the file folder. Okay, so how many bones you got in your forearm? You got two. The lateral one is the radius, yeah, and the medial one is the ulna. So what does this look like? Looks like a Monday, Wednesday class in here. Monday, Wednesday. Indeed. What's the date? 14. Okay. Hi, pardon. All right, so again, it's really important to know bones because you've got some major arteries that run in your forearm and nerves. All right, so what did we say the lateral bone was? Okay, and am I showing you correctly the lateral lateral bone? Yeah, because I'm in anatomic position, right? So the lateral bone is the radius. Guess what the name of the artery is right here? That's a radial artery. Guess what the name of the nerve is that's right here? Radial nerve. All right, so it's really handy to know bones. And you're kind of familiar with that already because a lot of times when you want to check to see what somebody's heart rate is, what do you palpate? You palpate the radial pulse right here, right? It's also far away from your heart, so sometimes we call that the distal pulse. It goes by distal pulse or radial pulse. And you're palpating the what artery? Radial artery. And so therefore we call it the radial pulse because of this bone right here. Okay. All right, let's see if I got a good picture. So here are the, this is the head of the radius. Okay, but now let's look and see how something has switched around. On the ulna, the head is the distal epiphysis, right? On the radius, it's the proximal epiphysis. Okay, and let's see if I have a picture. Not bad. Okay. All right, so here we got the humerus. All right, here's the capitulum, which is the radial part of the distal part of the humerus. It's going to articulate with the head of the radius. And then here is the trochlea. It articulates with the ulna. But notice, there's also an articulation between the radius and the ulna right in this location right here. So there has to be a dimple in the ulna to accept the head of the radius. So if we take the ulna out and look at it over here, right? Now I want you to be able to palpate these things in lab. This dimple right here is called the radial notch. Why is that the radial notch? Because what fits in here? It's the head of the radius, but now what bone is this? It is the ulna, right? So the radial notch is in the ulna. So it's the radial notch of the ulna because that's where the head of the radius fits in. All right, but now let's look at this bone. Let me zoom in. All right, so what bone is this right here where I have the cursor? That's the radius. So let's look in this region right here. All right, this is it. So this is the lateral bone. This is the radius. And then here is the ulna. And the distal part of the ulna is what we call the head. Right? Here is, and it's kind of round, and it fits into a dimple in the side of the radius. All right, so guess what we call this nice smooth area right here on the radius? That is the ulnar notch. So the ulnar notch is on the radius, but the radial notch is on the ulna. Right? So again, we name these different features by what bone articulates at this location. All right, so make sure that you can palpate all those things. All right, let's see what else. Let's go back to the ulna, which again is what, the medial bone. Okay, this is, all right, the thing that makes a point on your elbow right here. All right, and that's a big, massive process. What's the function of this process right here? Muscle attachment. Just say muscle attachment. Well, we got to fill some of that in a little bit later. All right. In particular, the triceps muscle attaches there. A big, strong muscle that allows you to extend your arm. Okay. And so this process is called the olecranon process. And when you extend your arm like this, this big bony prominence has to fit in someplace on the humerus. And where does that have to fit in? It has to fit in right here on the posterior side. So go ahead, get your elbow out. Okay, feel that point. Okay, and go ahead, extend your arm. And can you feel that process disappearing into the humerus right there? Right. So that hole in the humerus, or that depression that the olecranon process fits into the posterior part of the humerus is the olecranon fossa, right? So olecranon process fits into the olecranon fossa in the posterior part of the humerus. All right, we're going to do another little experiment. Here is the coronoid process, which you can't feel because you have a lot of strong muscles that overlie it. Okay, but it's going to be what? It's going to be medial. It's going to be about right here. And when you flex your forearm like this, all right, so this thing is going to be coming up, there's got to be a spot in the humerus that will accept the coronoid process, right? When you bring this process in very close to the humerus. And what is that called? So here is the coronoid process. When you flex, it's got to fit in right here to within the coronoid fossa. And then the head of the radius has to fit into, what's this little fossa called? That's the radial fossa of the humerus. Okay? So make sure that you look at a nice skeleton in lab and go ahead, gently articulate the skeleton and see how these different processes fit together and articulate. I think you'll be amazed at how well they fit together. And this right here, this is what we call the trochlear notch of the radius. And guess what it has to fit around? It fits around the trochlea of the humerus. Right? So it just fits right in there very, very nicely. All right, so make sure you look at all those different processes in lab. All right, so that's the bones of the upper appendage. All right, how's that sign-in sheet doing? Where's it at? It's there? Okay. Find your name fast and pass it around. We got about 15 minutes left. Okay, there's a couple other minor parts to the radius and the ulna. These little prominences right here we call the styloid processes and therefore muscle attachment. All right, and so now we're into the wrist and the hand. Okay, so bones that make up the wrist, there are 8 of them, they're called carpals. And I'm not going to have you memorize the names of them unless I get reprimanded by somebody. But I do want you to know that these 8 bones are called carpals. All right, there's one carpal that's interesting to note, and that is the scaphoid right here. The scaphoid butts up against this big, massive part of the radius. And when you fall, you have a tendency to catch yourself, and all of that pressure that's generated from the wrist goes up into the radius, and the radius has a tendency to fracture this bone right here. And that's called the scaphoid. And you can kind of tell, right, because the scaphoid has these really narrow processes on it, so it's not very strong. It's one of the weakest carpals that you have. And unfortunately, okay, right where this bone gets damaged and fractured is a nutrient foramen where a blood vessel enters. And so the blood vessel gets damaged when somebody fractures this bone. So what can you tell me about the recuperative ability of a scaphoid when that blood vessel gets damaged? As a matter of fact, it's very poor. As a matter of fact, the scaphoid has a tendency to be, instead of remodeling itself and getting stronger, it has a tendency just to dissolve away. Okay, so that then means that somebody has some deficits in their wrist joint as a result of that. Okay, so that's why the scaphoid is kind of interesting, because it's problematic clinically. It just dissolves away once it fractures, or major parts of it does anyway. So that's one bone that I want you to know in lab and in lecture. So if I say scaphoid, you're going to say it's a bone that belongs to the carpals. And carpals are found in the, what's a common name for that part of your body? That's your wrist, all right, which is a little bit different than your hand. Okay, then the bones that make up your hand, all right, so here's your hand, right, so not your fingers, but really your hand. Those are what we call metacarpals. All right, so carpals in the wrist, metacarpals that make up the hand, and they don't have names like all your carpals do, but they're named by what position they're found in. So there's 1 through 5, starting with the thumb. So the thumb is the number 1, what? Metacarpal. And your little, along your little finger, in this part of your hand, that's the number 5, metacarpal, making up your hand. Okay. Sometimes we find some sesamoid bones. And a sesamoid bone is a kind of bone that's found completely surrounded by a tendon or a ligament. And these are normally located. We normally have these here. And it just helps stabilize the thumb because the thumb has a lot of dexterity associated with it. Which means what? What is that joint giving away? What's the trade-off for having a very, very highly maneuverable thumb? Means that it's much more prone to becoming injured. It's not as strong as some other joints of the hand as a result. But these sesamoid bones right here help stabilize the joint to a large degree. All right, so number one, number two, all the way to number five, metacarpal. So here you can see that's your little finger right here. All right, and then we have some bones that make up your, what do you call these things? What do we call these things? These are? I haven't heard the word I like yet. Okay. You could call them a finger, but that's not really right. These are what you call a digit. Okay, so here are your digits. All right, so your digits come off your hand, and here are some bones that we find in the digits. And these are all long bones, and all the metacarpals are long bones as well. Even though this one right here is a really dinky, short bone, it is still what? Long compared to it is wide. So it's still typically reclassified as a long bone. Most of your digits have three bones in them, and these bones are what we call phalanges. So the bones of the digits are phalanges. Bones of the hand are metacarpals, right? And again, you name them from your thumb to your little finger, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So these phalanges have names, 1 through 5. All right, so this one right here will be the number one phalanx. Phalanges is plural. Phalanx is singular. Now, the thumb is a little bit different than your other digits because you only have two phalanges. You have a proximal, which is right here, and a distal. So this is the proximal number one phalanx, right? And this would be the, what is that? That's the distal number one phalanx, right? Proximal number one, distal number one phalanx. All right, so what do we got here? All right, well, I'll tell you what. What do we got right here? That's the number two metacarpal. And then this is the number two proximal phalanx. All right, and this is the number two distal phalanx, but now here you got something in the middle. That's the number two middle phalanx. All right, so that's how we name these things. And it seems really simple, but I don't know, it's problematic because I think it's so simple people don't study it or don't incorporate the information wrong, and a lot of people miss this on a practicum. And it's just so really, really easy. Okay, so what digit is this? You hitchhike with your number one, right? Your number one. Okay, and then this is your number five. Okay, hopefully that's not bad in some language. Okay, all right, and so then don't forget, the number one digit has how many phalanges? Only two. All the rest have three, proximal, middle, and distal. Okay, all right, and we're going to use the same scheme for when we get into the foot as well. All right, so that's pretty much your upper appendage right here. So, let's talk about the bones that attach your lower appendage to your axial skeleton. All right, what did we say? What's the structure that attaches your upper appendage to your axial skeleton? That's your pectoral girdle made up of your clavicle and scapula. All right, the bones that attach your lower appendage to your axial skeleton is your pelvic girdle. All right, and on one side of your body, you have one bone, and it's called the os coxae. So here is the os coxae right here, all right, a left and a right one, and in between them you have the sacrum, but the sacrum is not really part of the appendicular skeleton. That's part of your vertebral column, so that's your axial skeleton, right? Your sacrum is really part of your axial skeleton. Okay, here is a very deep socket called the acetabulum. This is forming the ball and socket joint with, I think I'm too far away to show you, the bone in your thigh, which is the femur. Right, so the head of the femur inserts into the acetabulum. And in lab, you'll notice that the acetabulum is very deep compared to the glenoid cavity. What can you tell me about your hip joint compared to your shoulder joint? What's the trade-off? Okay. The articulation doesn't have nearly the same kind of range of motion. Right? Some people can do amazing things with their hips, right? If you're born without arms, you really learn how to use your lower appendage at an amazing degree. Okay, that's what I'm talking about. So you don't have a lot of manipulation with your hips or dexterity, which means your hips are what? Very strong compared to your shoulder joint. It's really hard to damage a hip compared to a shoulder joint as a result of that. All right, but the giveaway is what? Range of motion is decreased. Okay. All right, so what do we got? Acetabulum, what else do I want to show you on this slide? I think I want to show you maybe the next slide. Okay. Now, this probably is the most complicated bone, except for some of the bones that you just started to look at in the skull, because those are the first bones you're looking at. So here I have an acetabulum, two different views. Right, a lateral view and a medial view. How do we know this is a lateral view right here? What do you see? You see the acetabulum right there, which has got to be what? Pointing out to the side. So in lab, to get started with this bone, pick it up and turn it around and model it on your body. Where does it go? Make sure you know what the superior end is. It's easy to see the lateral end, right? So find the acetabulum and see they've got to go on one side or the other. This big bony ridge is going to be superior, all right? And then the other thing that you should notice, this angulated piece right here, this is going to be pointing medially, and it's going to be anterior. So pick that bone up and fit it on your body, and then it's going to start to make some sense, all right? Otherwise, it will be just a nightmare to try to memorize these different processes, all right? So we said that this is going to be the more anterior part of the bone. This is the posterior part over here, right? And lateral and medial. All right, so we see some processes coming off the anterior side of the acetabulum. This is the anterior, and it is what? Superior iliac spine. All right, so here is one below it that's anterior inferior iliac spine. And notice that there are three different colors that make up the acetabulum, and that's because in development, it actually started out as three different bones. The superior bone right here is the ilium, and then this one that's posterior and inferior, that's the ischium. And we call it the ischium because that's the bone that you're all sitting on right now. And when you sit on some tissue, like some muscles, in your gluteus maximus, for instance, okay, when you squish that muscle down, blood can't get into it. And whenever blood can't get into a particular tissue, we say it becomes ischemic, okay? So it produces ischemia. And so since this bone is producing ischemia in that part of your body because you're sitting on it all the time, we call it the ischium, right? It's producing ischemia in these muscles over here. All right, the anterior bone of the acetabulum is what we call the pubic bone. So the three bones that make up the acetabulum are the ilium, the ischium, and the pubis. And look where they all meet. They all meet right here, right inside the acetabulum. Right. So if you find a real acetabulum in lab, look for these lines of fusion right within the acetabulum right here, just to kind of prove to yourself that it actually started out as three different bones. That's really pretty nice and easy to do. All right, so somebody remind me that we're going to start with this one next time. So a lot of you guys in lab are going to be looking at this bone already, which is good, except for the Monday group. All right, the Monday group, we're still with the skull, unfortunately. We're starting with the skull.
Bye.
All right, so see ya. So check out the, make sure you get the sign-in sheet. Okay, where's that sign-in sheet at now? It's almost in the back. That's good. Okay, so you guys got time. Yeah.
Does Army Thursday?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thursday. Yeah. That's kind of like the convention that they use in the schedule of classes. It's weird.
Okay.
I'm still not used to it.
Yeah.
Okay.